Mr. Chairman, distinguished colleagues and guests, ladies and gentlemen, as we know, this is the third annual religious festival to close out the State Fair of Louisiana. It was brought about, as our chairman said, through the vision of Mr. Vollmer and through the great devotion and tireless work of Mr. J.R. Russell, Sr., who has given so much of his heart to this great and worthy undertaking. 2 years ago, we were privileged to hear Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, a Lutheran minister. Last year, those of you who came out and braved the weather, as you're doing tonight, were privileged to hear a great message from Dr. Ralph Sockman, a Methodist. And we have our distinguished speaker of the evening. To me, my dear friends, it seems so very appropriate that in this 300th anniversary year of Jewish life in these United States, such a noted Jew, such a distinguished American, should honor Shreveport by coming to our religious festival. Our speaker is a champion of all great social causes. He is a warm-hearted and a great-souled gentleman. He is a practical as well as a practicing humanitarian. He is, as we know, a noted author, a brilliant scholar, a renowned and much sought-after speaker. As a matter of fact, we had to seek for him 2 straight years before we got his approval and coming down. Our speaker is a past president of that great rabbinical body, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, and he has been honored not only by his own alma mater, but as a recipient of degrees from many of America's most distinguished universities. Our speaker gave the prayer, as we all know, at the inaugural of President Eisenhower. And within this last year, he was selected by Life magazine as one of the 12 outstanding preachers in the entire United States. My fellow citizens, it is with a sense of high and rare privilege that I have been given the choice task of presenting to you this great American, my honored and my revered colleague, Dr. Abba Hillel Silver of Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Silver.
My dear colleagues and friends all, I was so happy to leave Cleveland, the snow and the ice this morning, to come to the warm sunshine of Louisiana. And I'm so happy to see so many of you enjoy this warmth this evening in overcoats and blankets. And so that you may carry away from this evening a message and not a sniffle, may I suggest to my respected friends on the platform, please to put on their hats, especially those who may not have on top of their heads that which some of us do have. I will also reward you for your turning out this evening by making my address very brief. My dear friends, this age in which we live is a great age, one of the greatest in human history. We are too near our times properly to appraise them. One requires distance in order to see great objects in their proper perspective. We ourselves are too much involved in the turmoil, the fears, and the conflicts of our day to see objectively the amazing new patterns of life which are emerging. Many people today are filled with dark forebodings and are quite pessimistic about our times. They are quick to describe them as materialistic, as lacking in idealism, in aim and purpose, as drifting helplessly to disaster. There are very few people indeed who see this age of ours as a great age, I believe that it is truly a great age. Great and historic things are coming to pass in our day. And I'm not thinking at the moment of the new world which science is continually disclosing. The new insights into the nature of matter and energy, the new sources of power and wealth, the new methods of production and distribution, transportation, communication. I'm not referring to the amazing progress in the medical sciences, which has so markedly improved the health of the human race and increased the average length of life, nor to the marvels of engineering and the miracles of construction all over the globe. Inventions and discoveries come in such rapid succession in our day that they no longer excite any unusual comment. We take it all in our stride. The flying age, the television age, the atomic age, and what next? The interplanetary age, perhaps. Certainly, man is achieving in our day in the scientific fields more in a decade than in 100 years, than in 200 years heretofore. But in characterizing our age as great, I am thinking tonight in terms of social progress, in terms of social welfare, in terms of human advancement and civilization. And I am persuaded that more is being done in our day for the improvement of the conditions of the life of the common man, for the raising of his standard of living, his health, his education, and for his protection against the disabilities of sickness and unemployment and old age than in any generation and in any 5 generations in the past. Never were peoples and governments so much concerned with the improvement of the lives of the so-called forgotten men, the exploited and the downtrodden, who had lived in unrelieved and unspeakable poverty, ignorance, and disease through these long and weary centuries. Never were more determined efforts made to bring about a fairer sharing of the wealth that is produced and a better way of life for all. Never have the submerged races and peoples of the earth, who for centuries groan under foreign or native tyranny, risen as they have risen in our day, to demand and to achieve, as they have to a large measure achieved, freedom and self-determination. Within the last 10 years, 1/4 of the Earth's total population, more than 500 million non-self-governing people, have obtained their political freedom. Imperialism and colonialism are in their death throes. Backward peoples are pressing forward into the light of a new day, and the exploitation of the dark races of the earth is rapidly drawing to a close. I don't wish to overdraw the picture. I'm not suggesting that our age is approaching idyllic perfection or that the millennium is just around the corner. There is not a spot on the face of the globe today where vast social wrongs and injustices do not still exist, and where the masses of mankind are not to a greater or lesser degree still underprivileged and disadvantaged. There is no country on earth which is altogether free from class conflict, from bigotry, from intolerance, from slums, from privation. The important thing, however, to consider is not whether we are on the eve of the millennium, but whether the major trends of our age, the major trends of our age, are in the right direction, are in the direction of the hoped-for good society or away from it. Is our age trying to eradicate poverty? Is our age trying to eradicate illiteracy and to raise the standard of living of all peoples, regardless of race and color and creed? Is it trying to satisfy the legitimate aspirations of peoples to national freedom and independence? Is it trying hard, in spite of frustrations and setbacks and to temporary defeats? Is it trying to organize the world for peace and for international cooperation? I believe that in all these major trends, Our age has given welcome evidence of great determination and of considerable progress. It is moving purposefully in the right direction. The abolition of war, the reduction of poverty, and the elimination of racial inequalities. And these are, in my judgment, the three major trends of our century. And this is my second thought that I'd like to share with you, dear friends. Destiny has singled out our own beloved country, the foremost democracy on earth, to give leadership to the world in this great age in which we live. This will be known, this 20th century will be known as the American century, in the same sense as the 19th century was known as the century of Great Britain. And I believe that American leadership will prove itself equal to the challenge. We are making blunders, we are groping, we are making mistakes, but we have a genius to surmount our blunders and our mistakes and to find the clear road finally which leads to the desired goal. I believe that American leadership will prove itself equal to the challenge if it will take counsel of faith and not of fear, if it will be guided by the prophetic insights and the wide perspectives of the founding fathers of our republic. We are not unequipped for the great task of leadership in the world. In the first place, we have a strong and secure base here from which to operate. Ours is a land of vast natural resources. It is not a starved and crowded land. We are not doomed to a low standard of living, unless, of course, we squander our resources, permit our fertile lands to turn into deserts and barren wastes, and allow our life-nourishing soil to be washed into the seas. The deadliest foe of democracy, my dear friends, is not communism. The deadliest foe of democracy is not Sovietism. The deadliest foe of democracy is, in the last analysis, poverty and misery and want. And there need be no poverty in our land. With intelligent management, we can produce abundance for all without expropriating the possessions of anyone. And then we are a young nation, young in spirit and in outlook. We do not belong to the past. The past belongs to us. To escape the past, your forefathers and mine came to these shores. Our distinguished rabbi referred to the fact that the Jewish community of the United States celebrates this year the 300th anniversary of the first settlement of Jews in New Amsterdam, now the city of New York. These 23 pilgrims who came here came in order to escape the past of intolerance, of bigotry, of religious persecution, just as a generation before them, another group of pilgrims from England on the Mayflower came to Plymouth Rock for the same reason, to escape the past, to find a new future for themselves and for their children and their children. We are not handicapped by old world animosities, although from time to time these do unfortunately creep into our national life and bedevil it. We have no threatening neighbors on our frontiers. And being young, we are not set in our ways and we are not afraid to experiment. We can still see things with the hopeful eyes of youth. Politically, we are not tired, we are not spent, we are not cynical. We are resilient and hopeful. And we have, and this is very important, we have a fine capacity for self-criticism, sometimes to excess. We are at times too sensitive about what other people think of us. But we are fortunate in that we are not given to self-glorification and national exhibitionism. We are ready to acknowledge our mistakes, to take the blame for them ourselves, and not settle them upon others. And we're not fragmentized politically in our beloved country. We do not suffer from a host of small, belligerent political parties, which have so often brought democratic governments in the old world into disrepute, and at times actually destroyed them. By and large, we have retained a two-party system of government. And people have sometimes expressed regret over the fact that there is so little difference between the two parties. That is our good fortune. When their differences become vast and irreconcilable, we shall then be confronted with real danger indeed. The very fluidity in our political party lines is our salvation. It means that here, progress can be achieved without revolution. And finally, ours is a long-established democracy, nearly 175 years old. Our democratic institutions have passed through many crises, including a civil war, but they have survived. And it is significant, and this is worthwhile bearing in mind always, that not a single long-established democracy in the world has ever succumbed to totalitarianism. Nazism and fascism and communism took over countries where no long democratic tradition ever existed, whose peoples were not experienced in the disciplines and the responsibilities of self-government. Here we have long accustomed ourselves to govern ourselves. We accept authority, but we do not worship authority. We accept it, but subject it to numerous checks and balances to safeguard the overarching authority of the people. We have a long-established tradition of basic and inalienable human rights, for which men are so desperately reaching out in the world today. And we believe that these rights are a gift from God, part of our endowment as human beings created by God. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. They're not given to us by the state or by a parliament or by a majority, and they're not subject to the veto of anybody, of any corporate group, of any majority. Such is our heritage. Such is our equipment for the role of leadership to which destiny has summoned our country in this great revolutionary age in which we live. And I believe that they are adequate if wisely and courageously employed. And this brings me to the third thought that I'd like to share with you. We must not take our rich heritage of freedom for granted. It can be lost, it can be dissipated. Democracy can be easily damaged and destroyed. We must be on the alert to defend it against enemies within and enemies without, against hostile propaganda, but also against hysteria and witch hunting in our own midst. We must now allow ourselves to be panicked by slogans and by words which are emotionally loaded. We should not resort to impatient and illegal action to obtain even worthy and desirable objectives. We should not overburden our government if we wish to keep it free. When impossible political and economic burdens are placed upon a democratic government, it soon collapses. Those people who want their government to provide them at all times with bread and circuses, as did the mobs in ancient Rome, must be prepared to surrender all power to their government. And we must work unremittingly for economic justice, for the avoidance of prolonged economic depressions, for large-scale unemployment among our peoples, may incite all kinds of desperate remedial measures. A fair sharing of our country's wealth and opportunities by all is a safeguard of freedom for all. And finally, we should resist all forms of bigotry and intolerance in our midst. They are the caries which cause decay and spread infection. Intolerance will disrupt our national unity in dangerous times and will call into question our credentials for leadership in a world which is not all of one color or of one religion. And so I come to my fourth and last thought, which I should like to share with you this evening. Above all, We must safeguard, with all the strength of which we are capable, the moral integrity of our people and the American home. I'm under the impression that too much of our thought in recent years has been centered overseas. We have been concerned with world relief, with world reconstruction, with saving the world from communism. We have poured out billions to strengthen democracy abroad. We have sought ways of extending the blessings of American life to people, some of whom are not at all anxious for it. And I believe that the time is here for us to take stock of conditions here at home. How really sound is the American way of life? How secure and stable is the American home? For it is the American home which, after all is said and done, is the foundation of our national life. If it is sound, America is sound. The quality of our family life, in the last analysis, determines the quality of our national life. And I'm afraid that from many directions in recent years have come very disturbing reports about the instability of the American home, the breaking up of American family life, the appalling increase in divorces and in juvenile delinquency, which of course is the most disastrous byproduct of the broken home. Now, many explanations have been given for these alarming conditions, and many solutions have been offered. And there is merit to many of these explanations and solutions. No single explanation and no single solution is adequate. You take these two world wars through which many of us have passed, they have profoundly unsettled the American home and threatened American standards of morality and the disciplines of married and family life. You can't uproot millions of young men and women from their customary environments where traditions and the habitual ways of life exercise a guiding and strengthening influence. You can't uproot and transport them to new, to radically different environments of great tensions and great relaxations of those moral standards which preserve the integrity and the sanctity of the home, and expect all these things ultimately not to be reflected in the quality of American family life. My dear friends, wars destroy homes physically and spiritually. The woman is a wage earner, and her growing economic independence has in many ways contributed to the greater democracy and to the higher economic standards in the American home. And that has all been to the good. But the price has in some instances been very high. The inability on the part of the professionally occupied mother to devote as much time as she would like to and as much time as is actually needed to the proper rearing of her children. And in some instances, unfortunately, the competitiveness of independence takes the place of that cooperativeness, that harmony, which is so vital for a beautifully and harmoniously integrated home. Take the agencies of communication of ideas, the radio, the television, the comics. They too have been impacting upon the minds of our children and our youth, and in some instances in many undesirable and unwholesome ways. I came across the other day a statement that during 1 week in 1952, a survey was made in the city of Los Angeles of television. And in 1 week it was found that the youth of Los Angeles were exposed to programs of 852 major crimes, including 167 murders and robberies and jailbreaks and lynching and dynamiting and saloon brawls and slugging. And these same programs, I'm sure, poured into my city of Cleveland, perhaps also into your community of Shreveport. Now, I am not attributing all juvenile delinquency to television or to radio or to the comics. As I indicated at the outset, many factors contribute to it. But certainly these are not an insignificant factor. And through them, standards and values and perspectives of children are distorted during their most impressionable years. Some time ago, I was told of a little girl who saw a picture of an older woman on the piano in her home. And she turned to her mother and said, "Mother, who is this lady?" And the mother said, "Why, that's your grandmother." "But where is grandmother?" asked the little girl. "Why, she is dead," said the mother. "Dead?" said the child. "Who shot her?" Now, what do all these valid explanations and others which may be adduced, what do they all mount up to? What is the meaning of the sum of them? They all mount up to this, dear friends, that it is far more difficult to maintain a secure family life today than it was in olden days, and that therefore greater demands must be made upon the individual, upon the inner spiritual resources of the individual man and woman. Greater wisdom is demanded, greater courage, greater idealism, greater sportsmanship to preserve for themselves and for society the one indispensable institution for human happiness, the home. For what profits it a man if it be a success in business, if he is a failure in his home? Or for a woman, if she is a success in whatever interest she may have, if she is a failure as a mother? One who fails as a husband and father, or as a mother and wife, fails in the most significant riches of human life, and nothing atones for it. There is no substitute for it. And what profits it a nation, rich and powerful, if millions of its homes are torn by discord and become breeding places of twisted childhood personalities, of lawbreakers and malefactors? I'm not exonerating other institutions of our national life, the school, the church, the government, society, of their obligations. They too have their obligations and tasks to perform in building good homes and a fine youth generation in our country. Society as such must do its share to protect the home. Society must evolve a system of greater economic stability so that the business cycles and prolonged unemployment do not put an unnecessary strain upon the home, a strain which often men and women and young people simply cannot bear because these strains are too great for them. Society must seek to avoid war because there is no more disruptive influence as far as the home is concerned, and family ties and family standards, as war. And society should provide proper housing facilities and decent homes for families. Much of the money which we send abroad, especially by way of armament, I'm sure could better be used to build homes here in our own country, to clear our slums and to give our children a chance to live in decent environments. Society should provide adequate education in preparation for family life and social agencies to help men and women solve the problems which come to confront them from time to time. All these agencies have their responsibilities and they must make their contribution, but when all is said and done, the problem is primarily a personal, spiritual problem of the individual man and woman who is concerned in the business of building a home and a family, and it cannot be unloaded on society or on government. The great effort, the greatest effort, must be made by men and women themselves, and they can make the effort if they accept and acknowledge and live by a clear-cut moral philosophy of life. They must decide for themselves what things are of primary importance in their lives, what things come first, what needs to be sacrificed for. And they alone must make the great decisions. And without such a voluntary accepted code of conduct binding upon themselves, they are lost and their children will be lost. Even with proper housing and economic sufficiency and all the protected safeguards and the undergirding agencies which exist in a community, their home will crack up. America needs the sanctions and the disciplines and the spirit of religion in the home. We have quite properly separated church and state. But we are now in danger of separating church and home. And that, I am afraid, may prove disastrous for our people. The Ten Commandments, my dear friends, are addressed to the individual. I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not. The hallmarks of free men is the right and duty of moral initiative and the corresponding right and duty of moral responsibility. And so I conclude by saying that if we want our beloved country to maintain a position of great leadership in this great age of ours, we must strengthen the basic institution of our country, which is the home. And we should begin, each one of us, a moral crusade, all of us who love children, and who among us does not, all of us who think of our own immortal souls, want a chance to enjoy a bit of happiness in this world, and perhaps lay up treasures for the world to come. All who want to make America fine in character, in texture, in spiritual strength. All of us ought to begin a crusade of self-rededication to the most beautiful and the most sacred of all the institutions in American life. I speak, of course, of the American home.
Thank you, Dr. Silver. My dear friends, you who had the faith and the love in your heart to come out and share this hour of somewhat frigid worship, I believe I might speak a bit lightly and say that you will agree to have heard Silver has been a golden experience. Dr. Silver, from the bottom of our hearts, may we of Shreveport, of all creeds, thank you for this thrilling, this important, in this much-needed message today. God bless you for the words you spoke.